This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Is it a surprise what's unfolding now in Ferguson, Missouri? Unlike the shock of the Rodney King verdict back in 1992 and the subsequent explosion in Los Angeles, the radically different views among blacks and whites of the O.J. Simpson verdict back in 1995. Is the headline in 2014 that we are becoming accustomed in the United States of America to hearing this?
The duty of the grand jury is to separate fact from fiction. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the five indictments.
That's St. Louis prosecutor Robert McCulloch yesterday announcing no grand jury indictment against police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting of Michael Brown this past summer. That decision, long awaited, brought out an anger simmering for more than 100 days in Ferguson and a collective feeling of betrayal among African Americans. Betrayal expected this time, it seems. And a war zone feeling of menace and chaos on the streets where an enormous deployment of law enforcement failed to prevent this. Hundreds of people took to the streets almost immediately in Ferguson in some of the worst violence since the shooting. Violence that President Barack Obama could do little about, even with this statement from the White House.
We need to recognize that the situation in Ferguson speaks to broader challenges that we still face as a nation. The fact is, in too many parts of this country, a deep distrust exists between law enforcement and communities of color.
That tragedy sounded like this in Ferguson. In some neighborhoods, storefronts were set on fire, bottles and rocks thrown, windows of businesses smashed, gunfire, reports of arrests. Shortly after 1 a.m., the National Guard was deployed in Ferguson. It watched over an uneasy calm as night became day, revealing that violence was, in fact, concentrated in just a few neighborhoods in the St. Louis area, and mostly peaceful protests were held in other cities across the country, from Los Angeles to Oakland, Chicago to New York City. Is it democracy or anarchy? Our first voice this hour says it's democracy, all right, but a democracy under threat. Reverend Osagie Fonseca grew up in St. Louis. Today, he is a pastor from the First Baptist Church in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, leading trading efforts in Ferguson in methods of nonviolent protests. He's been on the streets of Ferguson for the past 24 hours.
Well, the world witnessed last night democracy on fire and a broken criminal justice system. Young people, inconsolable, having been betrayed by every level of government, took to the street, and many engaged in property damage because their hearts are so broken. These are just not mad mobs of roaming black children, but rather the children of the nation, betrayed by the nation, expressing their heartbreak in a way that the world has come to see.
Now, some will interpret what you're saying there as that there was no possibility in the view of the people of Ferguson who are on the streets, no possibility that this officer in any sense was without fault here, could have been exonerated on any level, that an indictment was an absolute certainty from their perspective.
Well, I mean, given all the preponderance of evidence, as well as the eyewitnesses, the way in which this case was handled by the prosecutor, the refusal of the governor to appoint a special prosecutor, the way in which the police force responded with high levels of police repression in the face of peaceful protests, which was the dominant form of protests over the last 108 days. And then given the fact that every other day, dear brother, every other day, some black child, some black person is unarmed and killed by the police. Every other day, a mother is writing a funeral program that might be the elegy of the democracy. Every other day, children are laying teddy bears and candles at makeshift memorials because black or brown person is killed by the police or a vigilante with little to no recourse in the justice system. So what we saw last night is a pent-up anger and frustration by a generation that has been betrayed by the nation, lack of economic opportunity. And so it just seems par for the course, just again and again.
Reverend, it sounds like what you're saying is that violence, based on those circumstances, was the only democratic natural response to the decision of the grand jury.
No, I am not saying that at all. I am saying this, that our children are hurting, that our nation has betrayed them. There are 15,000 African-Americans in Ferguson. Two-thirds of them, 10,000 of them, have arrest warrants for minor things like not cutting their grass properly or putting out their trash wrong. The level of repression, one-fourth of Black folk in Ferguson live in poverty. In places throughout this country, up to 50% of African-American men are unemployed. Not that they're not seeking work, but they're unemployed. I'm saying that the realities that these young people live in, and I have been in the street with them for over 100 days. I've heard them say on the street time and time, I'm ready to die because I don't have anything to live for. I'm saying that is what produces. This is not to justify the violence of the protesters, but let us be clear. When we emphasize the violence of the protesters and to emphasize particularly the destruction of property, it makes me want to raise the question, how much property is Michael Brown's life worth? How much property is Eric Garner's life worth? How much property is John Crawford's life worth?
You make a compelling point, and of course, these lives are precious. There's no value to them. But when you say democracy is on fire, how do you reconcile that with how disengaged the African American community is politically in Ferguson? 12% of them voted.
Let's be clear now that African-Americans nationwide, because, you know, there were protests all over America. They shut down all three bridges in New York City. Right. They were on the steps of the Supreme Court. They were at the White House. Right. So this is not just a Ferguson problem. And even with low voter turnout, does that justify shooting down an 18-year-old child?
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that. That is there a way for this system to work with African Americans so disengaged, with communities so divided, and the police walking around with guns?
So I'm saying in a situation whereby you are constantly policed and harassed, where there's high levels of documentation of voter intimidation in the city of Ferguson and throughout the country, disengagement and disillusionment is grounded in material evidence. Every level of government has betrayed them. The governor at the state level refused to appoint a special prosecutor. The mayor said there was no racial problem in this town. The police chief unleashed, instead of bringing out an EMT and paramedics for Michael Brown, brought out dogs as though we were in the 1960s. Every level of government has betrayed them. And it is, if you listen to their music, it is clear that they're politically engaged. It is just that they do not have faith in a system of elected politicians who consistently betray them and demonize them in public space.
All right. But if this disengagement continues, this violence will continue because there's no mechanism for these communities to get together.
The violence we're talking about 108 days. It has been minimal. Compared to the high level of repression that they received from the police, over 400 people arrested in nonviolent and peaceful protests. So I'm saying it's been predominantly nonviolent has been the feature of what they have engaged in. And they have engaged in the system because protest is the reason why I have the right to vote. It is the reason why we have the 8-hour workday. It is the reason why America is celebrated around the world for freedoms. It is the reason why the civil rights movement has such a grip on popular imagination in America. And so then the violence, by emphasizing and focusing on the violence, it loses track of the fact that these young people with limited resources, limited access to the civil rights tradition, limited access to elected officials, betrayed by every national civil rights organization, that they've taken to the streets and have been largely nonviolent for over 108 days.
All right, let's get to that then. This is democracy, what we are seeing, whether some of it's not pretty or not, what we are seeing, this reaction, and again, it's around the country, it's not just in Ferguson, you say this is democracy, maybe on fire, maybe not pretty, but in action.
Well, the question is, will the democracy survive? There is a choice before the nation. and that choice before the nation. Will this be a nation that consistently, every other day, somebody black is killed by the police, and that in those majority of those instances, there is no justice? Will this be a nation in which black lives will continue not to matter? Or will it be a nation that lives out the true meaning of its creeds? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal and that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these rights, a right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Will the nation live out its creed? Will it live out the true meaning of its creed? Will it honor what it has said on paper? And given what we see on West Florissant, which is a reaction, not a cause, but a reaction to an injustice to an entire people, it seems the case that what we are seeing now, that when Michael Brown's mother wrote the funeral program, she was writing the elegy of American democracy.
Reverend Osagyefo Sekou is a pastor from the First Baptist Church in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, leading efforts in Ferguson in nonviolent protest. But he grew up in St. Louis and is very much a local soul, a member of this community on this very tumultuous day in Ferguson, Missouri. Thanks, Reverend.
Bless you, dear brother.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Stepping back from the streets of Ferguson, one of the things you learn in law school is that a grand jury can seem like just a rubber stamp for a prosecutor. The grand jury investigation is not an adversary proceeding with two teams of lawyers. A prosecutor goes on a hunt for an indictment. In cases of police misconduct, according to the Cato Institute's National Police Misconduct Statistics and Reporting Project, between April 2009 and December 2010, of the nearly 430 officers accused of killing a person using excessive force, only 30 were charged. Just half of those, 30, were actually convicted. William Yeomans has been an attorney for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He's now a fellow in law and government at American University Washington College of Law. William Yeomans, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
How do we set statistics like this into context? And is the grand jury a definitive decision in a case like this?
Well, I think one thing to think about and to keep in mind in approaching these cases is the role that we have given the police in our society. We authorize them to use force. We give them weapons. We do that so that they can protect us. Now, what that means, of course, is that there have to be limits. There has to be some accountability. But because we have authorized the police to use force, and we understand that they are sometimes put in very difficult positions, the law tends to give them leeway in making instant, difficult decisions on the spot. What that means is that both grand juries and juries tend to give the police some latitude. In this case and in others, the grand jury determination not to indict is, for the immediate purposes, final. But in Ferguson, obviously, there is more to be done. There is still a federal investigation underway, a federal civil rights investigation, both criminal and civil, that may produce some results. The federal criminal investigation is a difficult case to make. I think, as a lot of people have said, the federal standard is quite high. The federal government would have to show that Officer Wilson acted with the intent to use more force than was reasonably necessary under the circumstances. That means that he consciously went beyond what was needed to deal with the situation. And proving that state of mind can be very difficult. But there is also a civil option. The Justice Department has launched a civil pattern or practice investigation into whether or not the Ferguson police have serially violated federal rights. That investigation is underway, and it can look at a broad range of items in involving the Ferguson police, from use of force to the way they train officers, to the way they discipline officers, to the way they relate to the community, and to their hiring practices. And I think it's worth mentioning that their hiring practices are obviously crucial here, because the Ferguson Police Department is overwhelmingly white. I think there are only 3 African-American officers out of over 50. And what that means is that that frequently leads to a loss of trust among the community with regard to the police department.
So the feds could take up this question of hiring practices as a civil rights matter. The feds could take up this situation as a kind of, you know, policy of the police constituting a civil rights violation. Does the prosecutor have the discretion to act more like a officer of the peace in the sense that if it is the case that a prosecutor can, you know, indict, get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich, can a prosecutor basically say, look, we need a verdict here that clearly represents the community standards, and so we're not simply going to talk about whether Officer Wilson used excessive force. We also have to talk about the body laying around for 4 hours in the middle of the summer and just the whole level of police procedure here. Is that even appropriate in a grand jury, or does the prosecutor have that kind of discretion?
Well, no. I mean, the grand jury's focus has to be on the law.
Right.
It has to consider the evidence and determine whether there is sufficient evidence to establish probable cause to go forward, to charge the case. And a prosecutor also has an obligation, sometimes under law, sometimes an ethical obligation, not to go forward if he thinks that there is no reasonable chance that the facts can be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard if the case goes to trial.
So for the situation here with the officer may not have used excessive force, but is there a subsequent local investigation that can look at what the police did on that night? And is that a criminal matter or a civil matter, or is that just a matter for the, you know, TV talk shows?
Well, I think all of that is a matter for the federal investigation. So the federal government has the authority to investigate not only past way back historic practices of the Ferguson Police Department, but it can investigate the police department's response both in August and after last night's announcement to determine whether the police engaged in violations of federal rights. And my assumption is that the Justice Department has under investigation several incidents from August, and those can be prosecuted criminally, but they can also go into the mix in the civil case. And that civil case should not be underestimated. It can result in broad-scale reform for the Ferguson Police Department, and I suspect that it will. The normal course of these is that there is an investigation, they gather all the facts, and then they'll sit down with Ferguson and discuss what needs to be done. And it may be that at that point, Ferguson and the federal government will enter into an agreement about how to reform the Ferguson Police Department, and they may put that agreement before a court, which will enter it as a consent decree, which will then be enforced with court supervision. And that kind of decree can lead to significant change. And we've seen that happen with this Justice Department in a number of cities recently, probably most visibly New Orleans in the recent past. So these decrees can be very effective.
So the people on the street in Ferguson should really take under advisement that this process is continuing. It's not over. This grand jury is not definitive. There are many more issues to be taken up. And as tense as today is, there's more to come. William Yeomans, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
William Yeomans spent most of his career as an attorney for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He's now a fellow in law and government at American University Washington College of Law. Aftermath of yesterday's sudden departure of Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has produced a wake of Beltway-style turmoil as military advisors and analysts try to explain what it all means. This moment from an interview on November 19th with Charlie Rose suggests that Hagel might have known something was up.
It's not unusual, by the way, to change teams at different times.
So you would expect him to change?
What I'm saying is it wouldn't be unusual to do that.
Well, Professor Andrew Bacevich says Hagel's departure is a watershed moment in the Obama administration's military legacy. Bacevich is a Vietnam veteran and George McGovern Fellow at Columbia University working on a book about the history of U.S. military involvement since 1980 in the greater Middle East. Welcome, Professor Bacevich.
Well, thanks very much.
So how do we evaluate this departure of Chuck Hagel?
Well, I think he was the wrong man for the job in this sense. You know, Hagel, if Hagel represented anything, he represented the notion of no more Vietnams. And yet, when he became Secretary of Defense, the United States actually was enmeshed in another Vietnam of a sort. That is to say, in another endless quagmire of a conflict. And I don't believe that intellectually he was able to offer much to the president with regard to how to manage this quagmire.
But wasn't Hagel put in there to get us out of Afghanistan and to continue this sort of drawdown and escape from Iraq, and the situation changed?
Yes, I think you're exactly right. I mean, what you just stated was the president's agenda when he became president. I mean, he has said on many occasions that he aims to extricate the United States from this endless war in the greater Middle East. But I think given the rise of ISIS, the president himself has, for all practical purposes, made a 180-degree course change and has accepted, I think erroneously, deeply unfortunately, has accepted the fact that he's not going to be able to get us out of the mess we're in the greater Middle East.
So I was looking at all that, and I'm sure you were doing the same thing yesterday, looking at all the policy blogs and the various sort of defense Pentagon commentators. I mean, Fred Kaplan was typical, talking about how this guy was not a policy guy. It was a flawed nomination to begin with. There's no way he could handle policy. But there are a lot of different jobs at the Pentagon. Do you think he was policy flawed and maybe better suited for some other job?
Well, you're right. I mean, being defense secretary has to be one of the most difficult jobs on the planet. It involves not simply being a policy player, but involves managing a mammoth and complex enterprise. And I think it's possible to argue that Hagel may have been doing a better job at managing that building than he was of playing in the policy arena. Now, an interesting, I think, aspect of this is that the perceived weakness of Hagel as a policy player has ended up elevating the status of General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is now being referred to as a powerful chairman.
Professor Bacevich, let's shift gears here for a second. I was talking with a bunch of people who were on the management side at the Pentagon who were saying Hagel was revered among the kinds of people within the Pentagon who are concerned about, you know, sex abuse scandals, about the culture of the military, about trying to turn this place around and improve morale, get rid of sort of old funded programs that have long outlived their usefulness, that to a certain constituency in the Pentagon, Hagel is actually a hero.
Well, that's the scuttlebutt I get, too. That said, it's in that realm of Pentagon reform, certainly much needed, that change requires a lot of time. And therefore, if that's the arena in which Hagel would have made his mark, unfortunately, he's not going to make a mark because he simply didn't have enough time on the job to put in place the sort of reforms that actually might have stuck and might have made a difference downstream.
Andrew Bacevich, Vietnam War veteran and George McGovern Fellow at Columbia University, working on a book about the history of the U.S. military's involvement since 1980 in the greater Middle East. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Earlier this hour, you may have heard the voice of an emotional, passionate clergyman from the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, Reverend Osagyefo Sekou, who who may have left the impression that there is an irreversible hurt in that community. So I asked Reverend Sekou if he sees the possibility of a bridge ever in Ferguson.
We are going to stay in the streets. We're going to continue to protest. We're going to continue to organize. And that bridge is going to be built on the backs of these young people who have been in the streets for 108 days and who will not bow down. There will be civil disobedience actions today. While many of these young people have lost hope in democracy, I remain hopeful against hopelessness because their courage and their will and their might and their strength to say no more, not on our watch. And in that sense, dear brother, we have already won.
All right. So the protests will continue, but does that constitute a bridge in a community that's so divided? Don Marsh is the host of St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Don, welcome.
Hi, John. Nice to see you. I talk to you.
How challenging is it to take the pulse of an entire community on a day like today?
Well, it is very difficult. How do you do it? There are certainly two distinct groups at work here, at play here, play not being a very good choice of words. But there's a younger group that is totally angry with the system. They feel social justice is just something that doesn't happen here, hasn't happened here, and hasn't happened here for a great many years. And then there's the older group, the clergy, and some of the civic leaders who are trying to sit down and make some sense of all of this and try to find a way to build that bridge. But clearly this is not happening. One of the police officers, the police chief, as a matter of fact, of St. Louis County said last night that what happened here last night was worse than anything that happened during the earlier demonstrations back in August. So it seems to be escalating, and I don't think you build bridges on the kind of destruction that we saw last night.
What about the white community? I mean, if there is such a thing in St. Louis in the traditional sense, I mean, are people behind the walls of their, suburban neighborhood homes saying, well, let's just stay home today? And is there a sense of siege in the St. Louis, or is it business as usual?
No, it's not business as usual, and there is a certain sense of siege. A lot of schools have been closed. A lot of businesses have been closed. People are staying home. They're reluctant to go out. I have neighbors who, within the past week or two, have gone out and purchased guns because they fear the absolute worst. And it's awfully, awfully frightening to see people like that who are arming themselves. And I just dread the possibility that if these things continue, as apparently they're going to, if these demonstrations continue and some neophyte with a gun squeezes off around and hits somebody, God knows what's going to happen. I just really am concerned about that because there has been a terrific spike in the sale of arms here.
Now, Don, you're a public radio host. I mean, I would think so carefully about saying such a thing in New York, but I think the fact that you're telling me this right now is a sense of just how serious the situation has become. I mean, you're not a guy who's known for inflaming the situation or getting people all riled up.
No, I certainly don't mean to do that, but I think people are riled up. If they're going out and purchasing weapons, I think they definitely are at that point. Another part about this, John, that I think is important is the fact that, incidents like the situation last night, 10, 12 businesses burned, people hurt, a lot of arrests, is that there are large numbers in the white community here who are supportive of the social justice issues that the demonstrators are raising. But the more this sort of thing goes on, these people are kind of dropping off the bus. They're saying, we don't want to support this. And this has become the face of the social justice movement. So a lot of people who would otherwise be allies to those who are demonstrating are basically backing away. And as I say, some of them even arming themselves.
All right. If you were to design a show today, and I'm sure this is what you're doing, that would try to make this bridge happen, who would you call on in the community?
Well, we're calling on the people who are closest to it, representatives from the community, and indeed we are doing just such a program. and representatives of the demonstrating community. You know, it's really important to hear their voice and to understand exactly what their complaints are. I don't think anybody is unaware of their concerns. I mean, the social justice is a major issue here. It has angered people who feel they've been harassed by police. You've no doubt been hearing about the issue of fines and fees that these many municipalities in our area are charging people for minor infractions. And when this happens to the African-American community, if the fines aren't paid immediately, warrants are issued for their arrest, people are arrested, they're put in jail for a couple of days, they lose their job, they lose their income, and then what have you got? You've got a poor person with no income who is angrier than ever. And that's coming into play here. I frankly think that this particular issue, which, again, there's a committee that is working on dealing with this, I think after the death of Michael Brown, which was tragic in and of itself, needless to say, that this is the major issue. This and issues like this are what has the black community so upset. They just feel that they're being hassled, harassed, and put upon by the basically white power structure in their communities.
And before we go, I mean, this is not just a St. Louis issue here. I mean, there's stop and frisk here in New York City. There's cracking down on small crime in, you know, as a law enforcement strategy in municipalities around the country. Is there an illusion of peace and reduced crime in America that the skin of which can be broken very, very easily, as we've seen in St. Louis?
Well, I don't know about the illusion. I'm not that wise as to what's going on anyplace else. But I will point out that there were a number of demonstrations in other parts of the country last night in support of Michael Brown and protesting the decision handed down by the grand jury last night. And that would indicate to me that exactly what you say is present in those communities where there were demonstrations. And there were in some major cities. So that just take a Ferguson population, 20,000 or so, and put this same dynamic in a city of a couple of million, and wow, I think you've got the makings of a terrific problem if this thing continues to fester.
Well, you've got your work cut out for you there in the community of St. Louis. Don Marsh is the host of St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. And for the rest of the country, boy, we should value the sense of peace such as it exists in our communities and make sure we understand why it's there and how to sustain it. Don, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Hi, my name is Roseanne. I'm calling from Florida. I think that it's interesting how we put the burden of behavior onto the people of Ferguson who are showing their anger in a system that has failed them, but yet we expect them to behave differently and rationally, therefore making that more of a crime than the crime of injustice. Thank you.
This is Bill. I'm calling from Palm Beach, Florida. The verdict is in Ferguson, and since they decided not to indict, then the public should abide by that decision. There shouldn't be all these protests going on. What they're doing is destroying their own community, and that in itself is a much bigger crime.
Is the system working, or is it being attacked? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.